Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of the SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and today on the Roundup, we're going to be taking a look at three questions we've been hearing from international educators this past week. And before we get to those questions, we do want to say thank you to those of you who are joining us for the first time. As a result of promotional efforts, you've heard from either our posts or our friends' posts in the SMIE Consulting larger family of colleagues around the world. I want to say thank you for joining us live on Facebook. Also, those of you who are watching on repeat on YouTube, on our Facebook channel, as well as those listening on the podcast. So thank you for making us a part of your weekly journey through an international education world that is increasingly complex and increasingly smaller as we all become increasingly connected. So today on the Roundup, as we do each week, we take a look at three stories that we have seen rise up into our news feeds in the last few days and focus on questions related to how we as an industry are responding to these concerns and these fields, these questions that we raise. We also take all of these stories from our newsletter, our SMIE Consulting, All the SMIE News Fit to Share. Comes out on Mondays, free to your inbox, so you're welcome to go to our website at smieconsulting.org/subscribe if you'd like to get that free newsletter every Monday morning. We take three of those stories and develop them into a little bit more in-depth content here for the Roundup on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern, and hopefully we make this a useful piece of your international education news gathering and news sources every week. So let's get right to the questions. First up is, what is the future of U.S. visas? There was an interesting story this past week that was released that shared from a leaked memo that ProPublica had gotten a hold of and did a piece entitled International Memo Vows Shows Trump Administration Expects Drastic Drop in Demand for U.S. Visas for Years to Come. Now, obviously, we know this past year has been one of the most bizarre in our human history in terms of the impact a global pandemic has had on all facets of our daily life. But international travel is certainly one of those that has been significantly affected. For those unfamiliar with U.S. visas, how that process works and the money that's raised by people applying for visas overseas, for U.S. citizens paying passport application fees, all of that process, those on a normal year fund about $3.5 billion a year for the State Department. And those, the services that the State Department offers for passports for U.S. citizens and all the overseas visa processing they do for immigrant and non-immigrant visas coming to the United States, overseas U.S. citizen services, all of those are funded out of the application fees paid by and other fees that come into the visa processing pieces, either at posts, embassies, and consulates overseas, or here in the United States for U.S. citizen passport services, that type of thing. So this article that delves into the released leaked memo is showing that the services that have been offered this past year have been that were there significant drops. There was a 95% fall off in travel in terms of international travel coming into the United States, down from visa approvals plummeted from over 670,000 in January to around 45,000 in April, and similar numbers in May and June. The reality is, and not surprisingly, this year has resulted in across-the-board drops in every category of visas, not just student visas. We all know what's happening there. But the larger implications of this are that the funding for future visa services is impacted in terms of what State Department U.S. embassies and consulates are able to do overseas for potential visa applicants. So in terms of what the most shocking piece of this is that the State Department officials are predicting an 82% drop in visa applications in 2021 compared to 2018. And even into 2022, the administration is preparing for 2.6 million visa applicants, which is around 22% of the over 12 million visa applications made 2 years ago in 2018. So this is truly a seismic shift. And part of it is driven by just expectations. Part of it's driven by the pandemic. Part of it is just the reality of, okay, all this money that was supposed, that typically would come in for visa processing and visa services, hasn't come in because of the drop in travel. So as a result, the next coming years, 2-3 years, are going to be impacted accordingly. So this is going to have an impact across the board in the State Department in terms of staffing levels overseas that might be impacted by visa officers no longer having jobs. None of this is public in terms of what the cuts will be, but the impact is certainly going to be real, and it's going to be felt around the world at U.S. consulates and embassies, even after the pandemic the worst of it might have passed and travel starts to rebound. So this is a real challenge, and you also see similar challenges with USCIS through Department of Homeland Security, where 3/4 of their workforce face furloughs. And I know there was just some news this past week that has been put off, or at least should be put off, and that they won't be furloughing these staff, because that would grind the immigration system in the country to a virtual standstill if that were to happen. So we're facing challenges, funding challenges overseas with the lack of visa application revenue coming in, and here at home, budgetary challenges here that are going to impact our domestic services that Homeland Security as well as State Department are going to be able to provide in the future. So this is something that's completely out of the control of certainly State Department and Homeland Security, because they are self-funded by revenue that they bring in in terms of these visa services offered overseas with regard to State Department, and also in the United States, the Citizenship and Immigration Service portion of Homeland Security, the revenue generated through applications for OPT and other services, change of status, other benefits for non-immigrants and immigrants. Those things, because of the drops in revenues, because those applications aren't being filed, there are consequent knock-on effects to what's happening across the board with these departments. So all of these are out of the control completely of the average international educator. In terms of government policy and that type of thing, because this isn't really policy, it's budget. And that's something that this article kind of shines a light on in terms of what we can expect in the next couple of years from State and Homeland Security in terms of the main issues regarding problems we've seen in the past in terms of visa processing. It's not going to become easier until these kind of shortfalls get addressed or some other models of funding are put in place, which isn't likely to happen given the myriad of other circumstances that are impacting those particular departments, Homeland Security and State. So we'll see what happens with this. And truly, it's one that we're going to keep our eye on, certainly here at SMIE Consulting, whenever there's news that you can use and implement change on your level in terms of your planning for travel, your planning for recruitment, the planning for different models of recruitment and different models of international student enrollments, where many of us that are in the know were suggesting back in April, May that institutions for this fall should plan on their new internationals, or very few of them being able to come and offering an online only first semester, even first year, and or deferments. Two year admits for fall 2020, and then the reality, and the more we see what's coming down the road, the reality of a year of online or two before students come is something that I think is a reality for new Smart Thinking International offices looking at other models, working with your partners overseas for the first one or two years for delivery options for international students, because the challenges that this pandemic has brought into place have also impacted, I think, modeling and planning, and in a good way, innovation in our field that is leading to some examples of what the future might look like and can look like, even in a very disruptive environment for travel and for the normal course of operations for international education. So I think this is the time that this kind of memo certainly shows that this isn't going to be over by January. It's certainly not going to be over in the next year or two. So the models that we're using in our recruitment planning for how students will experience our universities has to change. And it's a reality that, yes, there are a few students that have gotten through, but they're the Hunger Games champions, as far as I'm concerned, the hurdles that they've had to overcome and eventually get to campus and be able to start their studies in person. That is the exception rather than the rule right now. And there's no real clear-cut answers as to when that situation is going to be resolved that will allow for a greater flow, an easier flow, a more regular flow of students coming back to the U.S. So we'll see what happens with this, but certainly the warning signs are there, and institutions that are thinking now more broadly about the impacts of this kind of a revelation on future enrollment projections, future enrollment plans for international education, for international students that you eventually want to graduate with your degrees, what that looks like for you. So that's something that we'll certainly keep you up to date on as things develop, but it's certainly food for thought and as you and your offices and admissions officers are progressing through dealing with your various models of plans or what the future might look like. This is an element that certainly needs to be involved, part of future planning for international recruitment and what that's going to look like for your future international students coming to campus or receiving a degree from your institution through a variety of means. So that's question number one. Question number two is a little bit different. It's more dealing with students that are already here. We've been dealing for the last 3 years with in U.S.-China relationship. It has deteriorated politically in terms of what the rhetoric that's been used on both sides related to to the views on immigration, on trade, on all the various pieces of the puzzle here. We've covered the spying angle before. We've covered the Confucius Institute piece. We've covered impact on trade, visa policies directed at Chinese scholars and students. We've seen all of that. But what we don't see, haven't covered a lot, is something that this next question asks, is how are we protecting our Chinese students that are here and frankly are being monitored by their government, agents of their government here in the United States. Certainly they're being monitored on social media. We've seen arrests of Chinese students when they've gone back to China for things that they've said on social media. We've seen Chinese student associations have been pressured by Chinese government agencies here in the United States to fight for the party line in Beijing on issues like Xinjiang, issues like Hong Kong and others that have are soft spots for, and Tiananmen Square obviously, that are soft spots for the Chinese Communist Party and the government there in terms of what's allowed. Certainly what's allowed in China is very different than what's allowed here in terms of freedom of speech. But nonetheless, there are apparatuses in this country sponsored by the Chinese government that monitor what their students, Chinese nationals, say in the classroom, say around campus and their social media profiles. So that is happening. No, it's not a reality. It's not made up. It's not a myth. It is happening. The article that I'm dropping the link into the comments section here on the Facebook page for SMIE Consulting is a Wall Street Journal article, so unless you're already subscribed, you're not going to get the full article. But the lengths that are detailed here, and this was also covered in a part of Karen Fisher's Latitudes newsletter last week, where she goes into a little bit more depth on the actual lengths to which professors at some elite schools, Harvard, Princeton, are detailed in the article. that of how they, for any Chinese students in the class and all students in the class, that they are given numbers, not their names aren't associated with grades and public announcements, public statements in class, that type of thing. Those things are restricted that for the protection of those students, because the faculty members in those classes and that are working with these students realize that there are some real issues here in terms of protecting those students that are from China that may potentially have thoughts and feelings on particular topics that certainly run contrary to the Chinese Communist Party line in that country. And so there are significant pressures that these students are facing, and then these institutions have some of these institutions are taking away some of that pressure and hopefully allowing those students the freedom that they want to have to express their feelings and concerns about the topics of the day. So I wonder how much that happens on other campuses and how sophisticated your individual campuses and faculty members' responses are to topics like this. If these are conversations that are going on your campus, I'd love to hear those and examples of what you're doing on your campuses to address this issue, if it even has become one, or if you're even aware of those issues. But in conversations with Chinese students who have gone through the process here in the U.S. and have gone home, they certainly share stories of times in their time during their studies when that either themselves or their fellow classmates from China had these kind of issues pop up where they were told that's not inappropriate by someone either. Someone from the party apparatus that's in the United States, either as a fellow student or from the Chinese consulate officials or other members of the Chinese community in the United States, that's not an appropriate comment for you to make, and felt that there was pressure on them to not do so because it would hurt, goes against the image that the Chinese government certainly wants to portray. So I'd love to hear from some of you if there's any stories that you have along this line. And certainly would be happy to follow up with you about those. So that's a very interesting question. Don't have a huge amount of answers on this, but in terms of what next steps you can do, but just making folks aware that this is all part of the larger of China's President Xi's attempts over the last few years to implement much tighter reins on the country in terms of national security law. There's a new one that is as a direct reason for these changes at some of these elite universities that are now using the code names and warning students regarding how they can speak in class and that type of thing. But the national security laws, we touched about this a lot of national intelligence law last week when we were talking about TikTok and WeChat and the national security implications here in the United States. Because of those policies in China that basically require all Chinese-owned companies, even though that they may not have to necessarily do it on a regular basis, but if the Chinese government asks, the Chinese Communist Party asks, the military asks for information on the users on their platforms, for Huawei to TikTok, WeChat, whatever it might be, those companies, as Chinese-owned companies, have to turn over that information if they're asked. We don't know when they're asked. That's never going to be made public. But certainly the way the laws are written, the companies have no choice but to. But that it's all that kind of culture in China that the Chinese Communist Party is as embedded into how people are monitored, how people how their conduct is impacted and judged. By policy, that's all something we need to be aware of here in the U.S. And it impacts regularly what we're talking about and have talked about with the Confucius Institutes and how the recent executive order to revoke visas of any Chinese nationals on student visas or scholar visas, researcher visas that were in country that are part of the military-civil fusion And that's that kind of amorphous mass of connections between those that are funding students to study in the United States who have military ties to the Communist Party. So that is something that we've covered on the pod before and on the roundup. But it's part of the larger structure of issues that between China and the United States, and that we need to be aware of as and when we recruit, but also how the impacts of that on those students from China that come to campus that are not part of that are going to be definitely impacted by those kind of laws. So being aware of them certainly is a piece of the puzzle that we all need to study up on, and not just go into these things blindly expecting every Chinese student that comes to the U.S. wants to be here and has nothing but altruistic motives for being here in the U.S. But for those that are and do come as true students and want to study, which is the greater majority of them, we need to be aware of what the issues that they're facing as Chinese students when they go back, but also what, in particular while they're here and under our care. So hopefully that sheds a little light on that one. Now, the last question of the day is one that we get a lot of grief from in the United States about our immigration policies. And there's no doubt that a lot of it is self-inflicted. In terms of the rhetoric that our current administration has towards immigration in a general scheme of things. But some of the policies we've put in place that are COVID-related, related to access to the country for travel and what purposes are allowed, what are not. We've been fortunate in international education, and I say that in quotes, fortunate relative to other years, and even other countries right now. Our policy does allow for international students to come into the country for study. That's not the case in New Zealand, for example. New Zealand, that has done exceedingly well in their management of COVID-19 and reduced it to zero cases, new cases that are from within the country for the last 3 months. But they don't want to mess that up. So they've said to their universities, we're not going to be able to, you're not going to be able to bring in any new international students this year as a result of the pandemic. And they've not put a timetable on when they're going to be allowed to, perhaps by the beginning of the new school year in February or March. But right now, no new international students are coming to New Zealand universities. That's just a fact of their existence right now. The government, in part, to its credit, has introduced a bailout plan of $51 million to their 8 universities and higher ed institutes. That certainly is something. But there are countries now that are not letting international students in. Australia had their numbers, international numbers, since February have dropped to very insignificant fractions of what they normally are. And there's still currently a ban in place on students coming in outside of a 600 student pilot project that apparently is going ahead this month for students coming to FCT, Federal Territory in Canberra and universities there to see how they can do it properly and with quarantines in place and that type of thing. So that's happening. British universities, they're opening up and they're letting students in regardless, which is an interesting counterpoint. But there are destinations like the United States that, you know, in the U.S., new students coming in can only come in if they're going to be studying fully in person or hybrid, where at least one of their classes will have in-person elements required. So that is our requirement for new international students. Returning international students can come for online only, but new students cannot be online only. That's the one major restriction in the COVID-related impacts of on policy that is in place that is a negative. Certainly, if COVID were not around, neither new students or returning students would be able to take any more than one class fully online in an academic term. So we have made exceptions for COVID. We didn't go as far as we potentially could have by allowing students to come into the country for online only. But frankly, a lot of the larger state universities are struggling, frankly, really struggling with the issues of an increased number of cases. We documented the schools last week that have gone from in-person or hybrid to fully online as a result of the explosion of COVID-19 cases on their campuses. And perhaps there are certainly going to be examples of smaller schools, smaller populations, more easily controlled, that have excellent testing plans in place to document these things and work with quarantine and isolation protocols that can get in front of these issues before they become major challenges that shut a school down and force them to go online. We've seen what's happened with that, but we have opened our doors. We've still allowed international students to come in, but frankly, why would you want to come right now as an international student when there's so much doubt about our country's ability to handle what's going on with COVID-19? And frankly, on-campus arrangements are certainly going to be far from ideal for someone new coming in from overseas. And I think about what we talked about last week with Michigan State. I think about what we talked about with North Carolina Chapel Hill and others that have made the decision to go fully online for the semester. Notre Dame did a slightly different version because they went fully online for the next 2 weeks, quarantined folks. And then are going to reassess what the future will be after those 2 weeks. But for Michigan State, starting in the next week or so, you had students, international students that had gotten visas, and we've talked about this scenario before, had gotten visas when they were going to be in person, had made travel plans, had made flight arrangements, had made housing arrangements on campus that are now completely torn to shreds. They can't come to campus now if they're fully online, even though they might have a valid visa. They could be turned around at the border by a Customs and Border Patrol agent because Michigan State is now fully online or will be starting fully online because student hasn't actually gotten to campus, been registered, and made active in CVS, and that's a requirement. If you're active in CVS, a current student, then you can be fully online, but they're not if they're coming in new and haven't yet enrolled. So this is a real challenge, and certainly the larger schools that are making those decisions now to switch to go fully online, it's causing challenges. But when you look at the policy decisions we have in place, that a fully online is not possible for a new international student to come in. We are actually not that different, or Canada is not that different from us in this particular regard. And the two articles I'll be putting a link to describe Canada's policy and Germany's policy regarding online study. And that for new students is not possible right now as a result of COVID-19. Canada's immigration caveat basically makes it clear that Chinese or that students who want to come to study in Canada, and the article I'm writing is from Politico, but it's basically going on about American students who want to study in Canada this fall or were been admitted and ready to study. But because those colleges have now been closed or are not going to be in person, the entry visas are not being issued. And if they have visas, they're not being allowed in if they're physically not going to be in classes. If it's not required, and this is part of their reasoning in Canada, if it's not required for students to be physically on campus at those Canadian institutions, they will not be let into the country if their courses are fully online. So as a result, that is making a very different environment, and certainly one that is driven entirely by health concerns, health and safety concerns there. So it's really interesting to see Canada taking that approach, but not getting nearly as much flack as we get here in the US for our immigration policies on that front. You also see Germany doing the same thing, and Germany will not issue visas to online-only students as well. So two major destination countries, both top 10 receivers of international students around the world. For New Zealand at that list, they're not letting anybody in, whether you're online or not. But certainly, we're not the only country that has made these adjustments to our immigration policy to allow for some students that might be partially online to come in new. But for Canada, New Zealand, Germany, nobody's getting in if you're fully online. So that's just something to think about in terms of the perspective we need to have on these issues, larger issues In terms of how we're conducting ourselves in our government policy. We all have our concerns about that on a larger scale, macro scale, and even particular policies we don't necessarily agree with. But we're not the only ones out there who are grappling with these issues. And countries like Canada, Germany, that have had COVID well under control, certainly aren't wanting to import a lot of students if they don't have a physical requirement to be on campus right now. And that's okay for them. And we need to understand what their logic is and apply that where we can to understand on our scale why we are doing things the way we are. I'm not making excuses for government policy in any way, but just in a larger scope of things, the context of how we talk about these things of government policy are ones that we all should be aware of. So that's what we have for you today on the roundup. And again, it's a big thank you to those of you who are joining us live and also listening on the podcast or watching us on replay or on demand. You are the heart and soul of what we do here at SMIE Consulting, and we're eager to hear your stories and help wherever we can in making your journey through this very turbulent waters that we're all struggling with right now a bit more manageable. So thanks for joining us again. We look forward to future conversations down the road. Cheers.